and this might be controversial, but I'm willing to talk about it.
Go for it. You're at sample code, a demo project. You should still treat it as production code. Listen to your developer relations team is step one.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Making Software, the podcast where we have real conversations about building better software. This is our first episode, and I'm very excited to be here because I have a great guest for you all today. So I think we can just get started and invite him to the stage. Welcome, Sam.
Here I am. Hey, Carla.
Hi, Sam. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on this podcast.
Thank you for joining us. So for those of you who probably don't know, Sam works in developer relations, and that's actually what we're going to be talking about today in this episode. I think this is a personal opinion, Sam. Let me know if you agree, but I think DevRel is kind of like a mix between a developer or engineer and kind of like a diplomat, where you have to have a lot of conversations in order to, well, finally make that better software for other developers to use. And I'm wondering, before you answer that question, how did you end up in developer relations?
I totally agree with what you just said, but to get back to the basis, how I started in developer relations, before I did developer relations, I was a software engineer like so many of us. I wrote software, I wrote code on a day-to-day basis for companies, products out there. But in my free time, I also started building experiments. I like play guitar, hence the guitars behind me. And I was experimenting with adding effects to my guitar sounds using code. And once I had some working prototypes of experiments, I started talking about those at meetups, and those meetups became conferences. And that led to me enjoying being on stage and pursuing a career in developer relations.
Did you actually know it was a career before you started doing this? Because in my case, it kind of started the same way. I started creating content on the side, and then I learned about it. I was like, oh, this is a job.
Yeah, exactly. No, I had no idea because I was a developer. I just dealt with what I had to do. I never figured that there were other jobs that I would be interested in that back in the day. But by being part of those communities, those meetups, those conferences, you meet a lot of people and you start meeting developer relations folk from around the world. And I realized like, hey, this is something that I might also enjoy doing.
Yeah, and I think it's also pretty new, or at least I didn't hear about it maybe in the past 5 years or so. I know there are people that have been doing it for longer than that, but I think for the past maybe 5 years, it kind of like increased.
It's been around for a while. I've been doing it longer than 5 years, so definitely longer than 5 years, yeah. But it's been around for a while, but it's relatively new as a job. That's true, yeah. I think it started at Google, and then people saw that it was a great idea to communicate with the people that are using your software, developers, listen to them, get their feedback. And so it just exploded. And now there's a lot of companies doing developer relations, which is a good thing.
Yeah, 100%. I think you just mentioned developer feedback, and I was thinking, I think that pretty much the first touch point for developer relations with developers is when a developer or an engineer is kind of frustrated using a certain software, right? And then part of our job is to be there to listen to them and help them, you know, build something that works. But that's, you know, sometimes possible, sometimes not possible. So I'm wondering, have you encountered a situation where you are in the position of, okay, maybe we can help this person by improving this documentation, or maybe we have to go ahead and make deeper changes in either the API or the SDK that we're using?
Definitely had some situations where I got feedback and I was able to help whoever gave that feedback by either fixing it myself. If it's SDKs or documentation, they are often open source, so you can create pull requests, or by talking to product teams within the company, relaying that feedback, starting those conversations with those product managers, product owners, to see whether or not we can include a fix or some changes within in next sprint or within the roadmap, so we can resolve some user frustration around products.
Yeah, I think it's very common. And it's also, I guess, a way of having or requiring some internal influence within a company. And I'm wondering, I think for me personally, that has been a challenging thing to do as a endeavor, because I also come from a background of engineering, so I'm very used to talking to product, but in a different context. Like, I talk to product to understand requirements, they explain to me what they need, and then I go and develop it. But the other way around, because now we have to come to product and say, okay, this is what's going on. You do need to have some sort of like internal influence there. And so I'm wondering, how can we use that influence to, I don't want to say convince them, but like help prioritizing these concerns.
Yep, and it's if you speak to developer relations people out, you hear this often that it's very hard to influence product teams because they have their own roadmaps, they have their own priorities, they have their own sprint plannings, and then suddenly some developer person comes in and like, hey, we need to fix this because some random person told me to fix this. And I think part of the solution is within the name developer relations. It's building relationships with the product teams. It's building relationships with the company, with developers out there, with communities, but also with product teams within your own company. And if you build those relationships at a certain point, they will start trusting that what you're telling them is actually valuable feedback instead of just us randomly pinging people on Slack or Zoom and saying like, hey, we got this feedback. So we built this relationship, we relay feedback, but we also help them out with whatever we can do to help support. Maybe it's promote their product features or help them launch a new thingy. So it's a two-way relationship. We do stuff for them, and then they end up doing things for us, like helping to fix a bug or change a feature or add a feature. So by building those relationships, I think it helps a lot to get stuff done from product teams.
Yeah, and I guess like you said, coming from an engineering background, we can do it ourselves. Sometimes we can't, but that's also useful. Another thing that I wanted to talk to you about was around, and this might be controversial, but I'm willing to talk about it.
Go for it.
So, as a developer myself, and probably yourself aware as well, we could be a little bit skeptical of being sold on things or being, drawn to buy a certain product. I mean, me personally, the moment I'm like someone's trying to sell me something, I like, okay, I don't want to hear more about this. So I think the way to get through that, at least, or the way I've been trying to do it, is by being the most authentic I can be, in the sense of, how can I help you fix this problem and actually, improve your whole development process and still contribute to whatever goal I have in developer relations, right? That's my controversial opinion. I don't know how you feel about it.
Totally agree with that. Authenticity is definitely something that works. People just like authenticity, and whether that's developers or any other person in the world, we prefer to look at people that are being authentic, listen to people that have a genuine story to tell, that are not just pretending to be somebody else or pretending to have something to say. And for developer relations, that's the same thing. When you go on stage or when you create a video or write a blog post, you can just put on your sales hat and write the most salesy thing, but that doesn't always work depending on who you're trying to reach. So what I try to do is I never lead with our product or with our features or solutions. I lead with the problems they solve. So I talk about a certain authentication problem. I explain how complex it is. I show them that it's way more involved than just a username and password field and clicking a submit button. There's a lot that goes on beyond that click on that button. And by illustrating how complex this can be, and by explaining certain problems, you also have the opportunity to show them that there might be easier solutions, which is what we build within the company. We build solutions for problems. So by talking about those problems, you have a way to include your product, but in a genuine way that might be interesting to developers. Instead of just starting with saying, like, hey, I work for this company, this is our product, use it because it's great. That doesn't work. I would not be interested in seeing somebody on stage saying just like, hey, this is my product, try it out. No, I want to know why. I don't know why I should dedicate time, resources, maybe even money to try that product instead of just trying it out.
And have you had a time, this is also personal take on this, but have you had a time where you had to, I don't know, maybe doing a talk or writing content or you know, any form of sharing knowledge out there where you, in order to make developers understand this product, you had to be like, I'm gonna build it myself to showcase it. And if so, what was it like? Not necessarily about like, you know, the current product you're working on or anything, just in general, because I think you said that you've been doing this for a while, so I'm wondering.
It's actually my approach to understanding it myself. And in order for me to explain something, often we try to explain complex topics. So in order for me to explain those topics, I build them myself. I don't build an exact clone of our product, but I build a demo that tries to implement whatever topic that I'm talking about. So I go into some specification, or I go into the code base of an open source product, and I try to understand what is happening under the hood, what is actually being done. And by building this and making loads of mistakes and getting lots of errors, eventually I try to figure out, and I do figure out what's happening. And by going through this process, I feel that I'm better equipped to explain it to people who also don't have a clue, just like I didn't have a clue before I started implementing it, building demos, figuring out all the details. So that's actually my process of building content. I always start with getting my hands dirty, trying to get in code, trying to build it myself, try to implement it myself. And then realizing, like, ha, that's why we have this product, because it's kind of complicated.
And what was the last thing you built that make you have like that aha moment?
I built a tool that explains Depop, which is a standard within authentication that lets you prove that you possess, or you should possess, a certain artifact. And it's something that it's relatively easy to use using our product or some other open source SDKs. But under the hood, there's a lot of moving parts. And in order for me to understand those, I built a tool that lets you visually explain what's happening step by step under the hood. Yeah, that was fun to build.
So you went ahead and read the spec and built it. I appreciate
I'm one of those people that reads
that.
specifications and actually does not fall asleep. I like reading those because there's a lot of information in there. And I think it's a skill that I acquired over time to just read specifications and know what's important and what's not. But I actually like doing that. Yeah.
I mean, I say I appreciate it because I mean, I don't fall asleep reading specifications. I do think it's quite technical. And like you said, it's important to know what's actually, what am I going to be using and what's more like to give context. So I appreciate that. The last one I did was on passkeys. So I was reading the, I think it was a FIDO 2. I don't remember the name of the, I should though. I'm going to cut this. No, I'm just kidding. I would leave it here. Not be authentic. But yeah, I was reading about it. To build it myself, quickly realize why we're building something for this because it was very, very hard. And thankfully, I could ask some people about it. Maybe I asked you, I don't remember, but probably I probably did.
You might have asked me something about that.
I did. I mean, specifications, I guess a good thing about it is they, I mean, I don't want to say they're evergreen because they're not. They have to be updated every now and then. But I guess like every other piece of content code sample that we build can even compare to like code, because in the end, we are showcasing how to do things with code. And they could represent some sort of technical debt in a way, or at least for us, because we need to make sure that things stay up to date, that, you know, you don't run into something that is deprecated. And then, you know, a developer comes and said like, okay, this is not working. So do you have any tips for dealing with that?
My biggest tip on dealing with that is any code that you write, either if you're a developer, a software engineer, or you're in developer relation, should be treated as production code, even if it's not. For example, if you write sample code, a demo project, you should still treat it as production code, which means that it should be updated on a regular basis. If there's certain vulnerabilities and dependencies that come out, like last week and the week before, React had some vulnerabilities. We went ahead and update all of our sample code that used those React and Next versions because, well, it's a vulnerable library that's included within those demo sample repositories. And even though they don't run on, usually don't run, should not run on production infrastructure or sensitive infrastructure, they usually run on your local computer for you to learn something about how to use us. It's still a good practice to keep those up to date as well. And the same thing when a new version of a framework comes out, you should update your samples. So by treating demo code, sample code, blog posts, anything that contains code as production code, as you would with your actual product, I think is a good first step of dealing with that technical debt as well. Because technical debt is part of creating software. And what we do in developer relations is still creating software. We might not be building our product, but we build software that helps developers get started with our product. So set aside time for that. If stuff needs to happen because of an incident or a new vulnerability, drop things and fix those. But don't just postpone it, because if you postpone it, you will probably just ignore it and forget about it. And
not good.
No.
The only thing I'm thinking about right now is, for example, when you're working as an engineer, you're building something new, at least in my experience, as you go through the development process, there are some things that come up and you're like, okay, we'll take care of that later. So you put it in a backlog and you know, I have to take care of that later. Then you have some other things that are like more reactive, kind of like what you just said. There was a vulnerability in a dependency, so we need to update to the newest version, so on and so forth. But I'm trying to think in terms of like code samples, content, quick starts, all of that. If you personally have a way of maybe going back every now and then and see, okay, let me check if everything is up to date or something like that.
Yes, I usually set aside some time. It's not on a weekly basis for me, but on a monthly basis, I'd say, to make sure that I go over all of my code bases and see if I need to do something. And often that's not the case. Often yeah. I can just go through my list, see that it's all okay. But sometimes you might need to update some dependencies, or an API might have changed and you need to make some small changes to make it work again. So I try to set aside some time for that. Otherwise, it doesn't happen.
No, I agree. My experience is more or less the same. Unless you're doing something with a newish framework or something that is not that mature, that's when, in my experience, you might have run into like, oops, I need to update this because whatever.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
And now, last thing from my side before we wrap up. I'm wondering, for any developer, engineer, person who likes to code, listening to us right now and realizing, okay, maybe we should improve the way we treat our code samples, quick starts, you know, or like the way we do offer our developer experience. Do you have one or two key things they could do as soon as possible to provide a better developer experience?
Yes. Number one, listen to your developer relations team. They know what they're talking about. It's actually true. And it's often a misconception that developer relations engineers are not technical people. We are people that work in developer relations, have worked as developer. as developers, as software engineers, they all have a technical background. So when they come to you, to a product team or to any other team within a company with some technical feedback, trust that they actually understand what they're saying, and they don't just relay any message as is. They will consider it. They will think about it. They will probably check if we've already heard that before, and only relay feedback that is important or we feel is important. Then it's up to the product team to actually decide if it's important or not. We, at least us with our technical baggage that we have, we decide that it's worth relaying to product teams. So listen to your developer relations team is step one. And then maybe another tip, again, treat your code samples as if it's production code. I cannot say this enough. They should be living. They should be updated. They should not be create once, drop on GitHub and ignore for the rest of your life.
I agree 100%, especially with the listen to the developer relations team. That's an unbiased opinion. All right. Well, thank you very much, Sam, for your time today to join us in our very first episode of Making Software.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. So this was Sam Bellin, who is a principal developer advocate at Auth0. This was the very first episode of Making Software, the podcast where we have real conversations about building better software. See you next month. Thank you for watching.
Let's ship AI agents with built-in auth and security. User authentication. Allow users to log into your AI agents. Token Vault. Connect your AI agent to users' apps. Asynchronous authorization. Add human approval for critical AI agent actions. Fine-grained authorization for RAG. Get granular with authorization control. Auth0 for AI agents.